Well, good morning. Nice to be here with you all, and I'm honored to be here. I want to especially take a moment to thank you all for being here, but I want to acknowledge Dick Humphreys, who I saw out there, and my dear friends Joe and Sue Goranzik for 30 years. They've been champions for peace and social justice causes, and they have been friends and mentors, supporters. When you're in politics, it's easy to drift off into a variety of other issues, and they have helped keep me reminded of why we're all how we're all a community and why we do these things together. So thank you, Joe and Sue, and Dick, you're over there. Thank you very much for inspiring so many people, and me being one of them. Of late, my life in politics consists of going to community meetings, and first I talk about taxes, and then I segue to death and dying, and then I remind everybody to vote for me. So it's not the easiest set of tasks right now, but those are the ones that I've chosen. And it's actually, if there is going to be an upbeat talk about death and dying, I hope this is it, because we are in a unique situation in the history of humanity today. We're the first generation that likely has some say about how we die. Up to now, pretty much, if you got a disease or an illness or an injury 50 years ago, you kind of got dealt your deck of cards, you got your hand, and you know that's what happened. Physicians, of which I am one in my regular life, by the way, I did a little over 30 years of hardcore emergency medicine, day shifts, night shifts, weekends, and holidays, not wearing a suit, but a scrub shirt and white coat. The last 15 years of emergency medicine were a level 2 trauma center, and now I work clinically, besides the other things that were mentioned. I work clinically at Healthcare for the Homeless, and I'm on their board, so that's where I spend my practice time now. But in those days, you know, physicians kind of knew you. We could do not much, hold your hand and take your pulse, but we knew the family, we knew the patient, and people often died at home and surrounded by loved ones. Now we have great modern technology, and people are surviving longer and happier and more productive lives. When I started in emergency medicine many years ago, if we saw an 80-year-old patient, it was sort of exciting and slightly noteworthy. If we saw a 90-year-old patient, the room was a buzz, and if we saw somebody 100, we'd all go over and look at them. That's how exciting it was 30 years ago. Now, most of the patients are 80 and 90 years old. 100-year-old patients are routine. And I like everybody to think that my life in the emergency room is all heart attacks and gunshot wounds, and there certainly is that, but it's overwhelmingly become geriatric. And it's great that people are living longer and happier and productive lives, but do you want to end up in an intensive care unit, hooked to machines and stuck with tubes and holes that you have and holes that we make in order to be alive long past any hope of survival? And while the same technology that has enabled us to live longer, it's also cutting us off from the experience of living and dying, and from the dying experience with our family and friends. And so one of the ways that I actually look at this is this way, and we can do a show of hands here if you're willing. How many people here, the two experiences that bind us in our life experience are being born and dying. I mean, after that, there's a lot of differences, but we're all going to share that. So how many people here, other than your own, if you're a woman, your own child's birth, and don't count as a health professional, have actually seen somebody born? Raise your hand. Okay, maybe half the room. Now, how many people here have actually been there, present, and seen somebody die? And this doesn't count your medical experience. Many of the people in this room, but not all. In other audiences, it's less, but isn't it interesting that these two experiences are ones that we actually don't have much personal participation with? And so when we're cut off from these things, we tend to fill the void because there's a tremendous psychic pressure to understand birth and death, or to feel it, or to live it. We fill it with various images and other things. I think on the birth side, we tend to succumb to a lot of sexual images, and that's why good-looking men and women are there to sell us cars and cigarettes and alcohol and trips. And on the other end, why I've always wondered, why is there that fascination with death in our culture? And it takes many forms, and I'm guilty too. So, you know, you read an Agatha Christie novel, or we see movies, or maybe there's slasher films. We run the gamut from one end to the other, kind of tasteful, sanitized deaths to wanting to see a lot of blood and guts. Now we're in a different situation. And the interesting thing is we, even though we Americans love our individualism, we love taking control, we have abdicated to some degree our control in this area. And the main way this takes form is very simple. It's in the completion of paperwork called Advanced Directives Living Wills. And I'm going to bet most of the people here have them. Let's do one more show of hands. How many people here have a Living Will Advanced Directive? Okay, most folks. I'm not going to ask those who don't to raise their hands. But near as I can tell, having been to med school, 100% of us are going to die. And in the United States today, about 20% of us die suddenly, but 80% linger over time. In fact, it's quite common now to see folks who have had one or two bouts of cancer and a heart attack, and people are functioning much longer. 60 is the new 40. 70 is the new 50, at least I hope it is. 80 is the new 60 and down the line, and we see people going on to their second and third career. So the advanced directive form is interesting, and in dealing with legislation in the Maryland General Assembly, there are a lot of end-of-life care issues and health care costs, and it's always hotly debated. And I'm blessed with a couple of Hopkins faculty, and one is named Keisha Pollack, who's a brilliant young woman, and I asked Keisha, public health question 101, how many people have X? How many people have advanced directives? Free, legal, straightforward forms that have been around for over 25 years. How many Marylanders have that? Because we could look up how many people have hepatitis C, knee replacements, glaucoma, croup, all that stuff, in hypertension of any number of the 50 types of hypertension. We can look that up. So Keisha went and did this comprehensive search on the topic using all the resources of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health and came back with the following information. That had never been looked at. Been studied a little bit in nursing homes, in cancer practices, and in senior centers, but not across the population. And that told me two things. One, even public health researchers, this topic is so taboo and so tense that we can't talk about it in general culture, but then it's so taboo that even public health researchers were blinded to doing the basic, simple question about any public health question. How many people have X? And number two, it told me that here's an opportunity for a study. So we went out, we got a grant, and we did the study. We did a formal survey. I met somebody here this morning who is a Hopkins statistician. There she is. And so we had full statistician help, or when I took it in school, we called it sadistics, but it's statistics. It's a tough course. And this is what we found. Across the population, meaning people 18 years old and up, in Maryland, and we extrapolated to the United States, about a third of the population has advanced directives, living wills, medical power of attorney. And we asked how many people want them, and about 85, 90% of the people want them. So somewhere between 30% and 80% is this big gap. And we started to ask some questions about what's going on and who are these folks. Not surprisingly, perhaps, we found that the older, richer, and whiter you are, the more likely you are to have an advanced directive. And the younger and poorer and darker skinned you are, the less likely. In fact, in the minority population, it only runs about 15%. And there are historical and other reasons, distrust of the healthcare system, other kinds of things. But ultimately, this is about empowerment and dignity. There are very few things in healthcare today where you can have some degree of control. We tend to push people around. That's what we do. We're arrogant, we're smart, we know it all, and we tend to tell you what you need. But here's an area, end-of-life care, where you can actually start exerting some control. And it's not just, by the way, for old people or seniors. The three most famous cases in American legal history were all women under 30. Cruzan, Quinlan, and Terry Schiavo from 2005, most people remember. In fact, it's probably even more essential that young people do it, because they will not have those lingering illnesses. If they're going to succumb, it's going to be a sudden illness or a sudden injury of some type. And when my daughters turned 18, I gave them advanced directive forms, and one of them turned to me and she said, "Well, Dad, you know, when I was 16 and got my driver's license, I checked organ donation." Already had, you know, she'd already given this matter some thought. And of course, we discussed it, and she said, "Well, when I'm 18, it's one thing. When I'm 28, something else, 38, 58, 88. As your values and life circumstances and belief systems change, you can update your advanced directive as much as you like. Let me just take a moment and tell you what an advanced directive is. I think most of you know, but part of maybe because so many of you have them already, what I would suggest is that we all appoint ourselves ambassadors and get everybody else to complete them. Bring this up in all the settings where we work, family, and so on, and say, hey, have you done advanced directive? Advanced directive is three parts. The first part is, what kind of care do you want when you can't make your own medical decisions? And there's really kind of three choices, roughly. Choice one is, I want everything done no matter what, keep me going, just keep pushing it. And on the other end is, you know, let me go pretty quickly, pull the plug kind of thought. But most of us don't want those extremes. We choose the middle, which is keep me going as long as I have a reasonable chance of functioning. I'm kind of aware of what's going on, and I'm not in pain that can't be treated. I personally don't want to end up in an ICU doing things to folks. So most of us choose that middle path. Now, I will tell you, as a health practitioner, too many times, and I bear, you know, genuine guilt in my soul over things I've done to people. 95-year-old nursing home patient, bouncing back and forth from the nursing home. Nobody has completed a do not resuscitate form, DNR forms. By the way, at Lifebridge Health, just to show you the power of words, they've done a great thing. Lifebridge is Sinai Northwest. They've changed DNR, do not resuscitate, which sounds like you're withholding something. The term they use now is allow natural death. And very powerful concept just to change the wording. But that patient comes in and maybe has a regular heartbeat, the blood pressure is going down, and this is what I've done in the emergency room. And then they have a cardiac arrest. So the first thing, you've all seen CPR, where you put hands on the chest and you start thumping, and you feel all the ribs crack at the sternum. So every push is crunch, crunch, crunch. If you ever had one broken rib, imagine all your ribs broken at your sternum. And then because they're not breathing, we put a tube in. I put a tube in. I don't know why I say we, I do it. Put a tube in the windpipe, which is another whole procedure, jamming this thing down. And then, because they often don't have access to we don't have access to give medicines by vein or blood drawing. Then I put a large bore IV, a big needle, in either the neck or underneath the clavicle or in the groin, and that's another whole procedure. And while I'm doing this and the entire staff is around, we all know that this will be good for 2 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe 2 days. That's what happens. And I, you know, that's not what I went into healthcare for. And this comes up more and more often. It's not the outlier event now, it's the normative event. That's what's going on. The demographics of U.S. society, the baby boom generation, is a giant group of people that are now making these decisions for themselves and their family. So it's like the snake that swallowed a pig. You know, there's the snake, and then there's this giant bulge, and then there's the rest of the snake. We're that giant bulge. So the first part of the advanced directive is, what kind of care do you want? And you can go into more specifics, although there are forms, and they're easily available, downloadable from the Maryland Attorney General's website and their religious organizations or whatever. That's the first part. The second part is designating a healthcare agent, someone who will make decisions for you in the event that you can't, because those three general concepts break down when you get to some specifics. Do we do an x-ray? Do we do an MRI? Do we do an appendectomy when the person's 90-year-old and demented and has been in a bed? Or what those decisions? So you have to choose somebody you trust. You should discuss it with them. By the way, you can also put in your advance directive somebody you don't want to be involved in your medical decisions, like, please don't let my sister be involved because she's wacky. So you can don't have to let those people participate. You can put that in there too. And you specify, and you should discuss with that person. You can change that person whenever you like, and you can put in others. So for me, it's my wife first. Hopefully she won't pull the plug too fast. And then after that, it's two of our three daughters. And one daughter's had a lot of health problems, and so she's a wonderful kid, but I didn't want to include her. But the other two, I've had better discussions about what I want in that point. So that's how I've specified mine. And the third part of the advanced directive is other things like organ donation and what kind of funeral cemetery that you want. Personally, because I think it's always good to share personally, I'm opting for a green burial, you know, and those kinds of things, because I don't want anybody to spend that much money to put me into a hole in the ground. I just want my molecules returned to the earth and let it go and spend the money on a party. Now, some of this came to me from a personal experience. My parents were divorced when I was young. My father evaporated and disappeared, but my mother remarried. And I got very lucky. She married a wonderful guy, so I had a good stepfather. And Max had rheumatic fever as a young man. It was out of his control, and he had valvular heart disease and then later other kinds of complications. And when he was well into his 70s, he ended up on dialysis. And he was doing okay for a while, but then eventually he began to really deteriorate badly. And he couldn't function, and he couldn't think. And these were the things that, of course, were important to any of us, and especially important to him. And he could see that he only had a few months to go, maybe. And one day he called me up, and he said, I'm not going back to dialysis. I said, well, Max, that means, you know, the end. He said, I know what it means. I'm not going back. I want you to come and be with me. So my mother and I took care of him for about the next 3 or 4 days. Family and friends gathered. And a lot of tears and laughter, and we all said goodbye and enjoyed it. And the next 3 or 4 days, we just stayed with him till he died quietly at home. That's the only person I've ever seen die other than in a hospital. And such a contrast to die quietly at home, surrounded in that environment, rather than the frenetic, hysterical, high-tech death that I see all the time. And so that was a really seminal experience in my life. And so at this point in my career, I thought, well, I got to tackle the big one. It's the death and dying issue. And the other thing that happens, by the way, when you complete an advanced directive, because it forces us to think about these things, it actually is a very spiritual experience. It's kind of enlightening. I mean, a lot of the great poetry and music, as we've heard, and wisdom of the ages and wisdom from the sages comes as people contemplate life and death. And so we have this form. And the challenge, of course, is that not enough of us complete it. Even though we're ardent about our individualism and passion about control, we abdicate in this area. As somebody said about the young child on the toilet, who said, no job is complete till the paperwork is done. You basically, in the end of this day, you know, if you haven't done it, if you have friends, I just want you to complete the darn paperwork. That's all it is. It's 4 or 5 pages. You have to think about it, but you check it. And once you do that, you put it aside. You share it with the folks that you need to, your doctor, your lawyer, clergy, family members, cousins, whatever you need to do. I carry one with me when I travel, and that's it. And maybe it'll never come up, but you don't know. We all know that life is full of uncertainties, and we don't know what's going to happen. There are a couple of other issues about advanced directives, and is Q&A allowed in this context? We can, yeah, maybe, okay. Well, it's Unitarian Church, we can make the rules, right? So think about any that you have, but there's some other issues. One, healthcare practitioners don't always honor them. We don't see them often enough, and when we do, we often don't know what to do. And it makes a big difference. And I'm gonna tell you a story, one time. It was about an 88-year-old lady. She lived alone. Her husband had passed. She was high-functioning, doing well, and she collapsed at home. It was a fairly common scenario. It's so common that in the emergency room, we have a shorthand for it. It's called LOLFOF. We write that on the chart. Little old lady found on floor. We have to have a little gallows humor in my job because of the nature of the intensity. So LOLFOF. And the paramedics come and they start their resuscitative efforts, bring her to the emergency room. We do the full court press. And among the many things, of course, is a CAT scan, which reveals a massive intracranial hemorrhage. You know, a minute before, she was doing fine, and now it's just blood, and there's no recovery from that. The family begins to gather, and they arrive, and we have the family room. Maybe some of you had that occasion to be there. And so they gather bit by bit by bit. And this is what happens. When families gather, sometimes, especially under crisis situations, there's a little bit of tension, and some old wounds begin to open up. It's in the emergency room, it's kind of like Thanksgiving in these situations, but much worse, much worse. But you've all had those family gatherings where, you know, little stuff begins to rise and a lot of resentment surface. And what we often see is the people who are closer to the patient say, she had a good life, let her go. And the people who are farther away and have seen her left say, do everything you can. So I'm getting, you know, let her go, do everything you can, and, oh, and by the way, you know, we're going to sue you and report you to the board if you don't do everything. This finally, there's kind of a quorum there, and the patient, and I'm back and forth between the patient, the family room, and some other patients. And she had an advance directive. Somebody obtained it, brought it in, and I read it. And then I'm in the room, and it's kind of this debate's ensuing, and then there's a quiet moment, and they all look at me. And we've done all the things. We've had the neurosurgical consult and the cardiology consult, and the woman is on pressors, that is IVs that are keeping her heart and blood pressure up. She's on a respirator with a tube in her windpipe that I put. And so I say, look, here's what advanced directive says. If I have no chance of meaningful recovery, just let nature take its course. And I read that. I said, this is like she's talking to me personally. My responsibility, I appreciate all the input, is to the patient. And this is just as good if she were talking to me. It's her decisions. So I'm going to respect that. And you might think at that moment it's going to be an explosion. But in fact, it's not. Everybody quiets down. And I said, I'm going to go in the room, and any of you want to come with me, and a nurse there will escort you in, and you can be there. And I'll pull out the windpipe, we'll stop the IVs, and you can be there. And they were. And they were all much more gratified. So when I talk about advanced directives, it's not just about me as the patient. If I really believe the things that I say about caring and loving for my family, that's where it really pays off. Now, no discussion of healthcare is complete without talking about money. And we talk about money all the time. Tail wags the dog right now. We've created this healthcare system that is confusing and expensive and somewhat crazy. Right, Richard? Single payer, thank you. And I'm for that. I vote for it every year. It goes down every year, but I'm going to hang in there on it. And I'll take an applause line anytime. I'm in politics. So, but let me give you some numbers. 25% of healthcare, of Medicare dollars, the federal program that services seniors and others, 25 to 30% is now end-of-life care. That's a lot of money, billions of dollars. Medicaid, the largest single item in the state budget, which is about $4 billion, about $500 million of that is end-of-life care. And we know that Medicaid patients have a very low rate of completion of advanced directives, because many of us come to this because we're married and have a kid and maybe have our first few assets in life, maybe a house or a condo or something, and then somebody says, you need to make out a will. By the way, here's this piece of the advanced directive, which we put aside and never do. But if you don't have assets by definition, no one's going to talk to you about that. At Healthcare for the Homeless, where my patients are lucky if they have $3 so they can stay in a shelter, they're actually all have thought about life and death, as most humans have, and I always ask them, do you have an advance directive? And I have a stack there, and I give one to them. Whether they fill it out or not, I don't know, but I try to do that. If you have private insurance, it's a colossal amount of money there. Now, most of the ways we reduce healthcare costs are pretty heavy-handed. What do? We create more bureaucracy that makes it harder for providers to get paid. I'm a provider. I like to get paid, just like you do for work. We make rules that are so complicated that no patient can understand them, no person can understand them. I remember a bill hearing. I was full of all the healthcare experts of the state, and I said, who here, raise my hand, I said, who here, if they went to the hospital today and had a procedure, could know what it would cost? Not one hand went up. And I said, well, if we don't know, how do we expect anybody else to understand this? It's, you know, but I don't want those important healthcare decisions for me or for you made by the heavy hand of government. I certainly don't want it made by the heavy hand of insurance companies. I don't think it should be made by religious institutions. It shouldn't be made by ethics committees. It doesn't need to be made by doctors and lawyers, doctors and nurses working in the hospital. This is one where you get to make the call. You get to do it according to your own values. And if you want to have everything done, that's fine. I will honor that. It may not be what I personally would want, but there are many times I discuss with patients, my job is a doctor. I explain the options as best I can, the pros and cons of everything. My job as a legislator, I want to make sure everybody knows their rights. And then, I try to honor those things. This is a rare situation that we're all going to confront sooner or later. And so rather than not have the discussion and keep our heads buried and refuse to talk about death and dying, this is a great opportunity to talk about it. I was at a political reception, which I have to go to frequently, and I found myself, wandering around with, drink in one hand and a meatball on a toothpick in the other, and I found myself in the corner of the room with two attorney lobbyists who were among the toughest, nastiest lobbyists that I ever have to deal with. And they're kind of really hard, flinty guys, and they have no brook, no quarter on anything. And so we're talking, and they're talking about some issue, and then they turn to me and they say, "Well, what are you doing lately?" And I said, "Well, I wrote this book, The Better End: Surviving and Dying on Your Own Terms in Today's Modern Medical World." And I'm really thrilled that Maya Angelou, the great Maya Angelou, endorsed it on the front cover. Not, by the way, because she needed to put her name on my book to advance her career. She really liked the book, and she read the manuscript beforehand. I got to spend some time with her, and it was a thrilling experience. And I said, "That's what I'm doing, it's about this." And then they both started to tell me their stories that they had just recently gone through, one with his mother and another with a sister who had gone through the dying process. And their whole countenance changed. They started, you know, looking like human beings and crying a little bit. And I didn't even know they had a heart. It was, you know, so wow, you guys. And so what I'm finding is everybody's got the stories, but we're just not in a comfortable position enough to share them. I think about breast cancer 30 years ago. Women couldn't talk about it. Now, it's okay. Mental illness, alcoholism in families, these are AIDS maybe. These are among the taboo topics, or have been. But they change. And we've seen changes in policies and in attitudes before. Sometimes we take them for granted. Certainly things like women's right to vote, the civil rights movement, but even more mundane things. When my first year in the legislature in 1995 was this very radical bill that would ban smoking in restaurants. That's right, it's a big issue. And I was on the committee that was going to vote on that. So I'm one of 22 people listening, and the people who came in to oppose made it sound like if we voted for this, Western civilization would end. Everybody, all the restaurants are going to close on Maryland, you know, especially Montgomery County and Prince George's County. They're all just going to close. All the people are going to be thrown out of work. Tax revenue will go down. All those college students who have summer jobs waiting tables, out of work. You vote to ban smoking in restaurants, that's what's going to happen. Wow. We voted to ban smoking in restaurants, and in fact, everything worked out fine. And no one now could possibly put in a bill to reintroduce smoking in restaurants. It just couldn't happen, you know? The birth experience 50, 60 years ago was what? Am I doing okay on time? Okay. 50, 60 years ago, you know, this was the stereotype. The mother was whisked into the birthing suite, the operating room, knocked out, baby pulled out, baby wrapped up in a blanket, put under some things that looked like McDonald's French fry heating lamps. The father was pacing, smoking, preferably behind a big glass window with all the other fathers, and then they'd come out and say, "Well, there's yours. It's in that bassinet, you know, fourth row, third from the left." And you go, "Ooh, that's my baby." You know, that's what birth was. Now, the advantage, if their presumed advantage of that was, that was safer and healthier in many respects. Sometimes I wonder about that, but generally speaking, was an improvement. But that technology cut people off from the birth experience. But it changed. People said, "Wait, I don't want to have that." And what did our baby boom generation do? So we want to be present at the birth. And so hospitals changed. Birthing rooms started to look like family rooms. Family members and significant others were present. Heck, people take videotapes and they show them to their friends and family of the baby being born. You know, the baby comes out and they put it on the mother's tummy. And a whole set of different things happen. Breastfeeding hopefully continues to be encouraged. Now we're on confronting the other end of life, the other circumstance of life, the end of life. And so this is about empowerment. I mean, if I'm hit by a truck, I want the best the technology has to offer. Absolutely. If I collapse with a heart attack, sure. But if I'm dying of cancer, lingering illness, you know, I don't want to end up in an intensive care unit, flogged beyond any hope. And it is at times closer to torture. So the better end is really stories with practical information. This is not a civics rant. It's not a moral or ethical discussion. It really is about stories, which is why Maya Angelou liked it. I should say also that Ben Carson endorsed the book, and we all know he is a great neurosurgeon at Hopkins, and he wrote, "I've seen so many families that could have benefited greatly from this book. I hope it will be widely read. However, whether you want to approach the book or not, what I hope you do is start having these discussions like those two folks. Start talking. Let's have this discussion, because I think we're on the cusp of a change. And it's going to be up to us and people like you and me to start saying, it's okay to talk about death and dying. And nobody has to all go running for the exits or freaking out or think it's some ghoulish thing. This is the reality we're in. But we're in a unique position. We can define to some degree our own reality, and I hope we do. And I thank you very much for listening. So thank you. And I'll be in the back selling books and talking about this issue all you want. Thanks very much.